You see, people collect all kinds of things. New, old, priceless, worthless. Darling, it doesn't matter what. I simply must know why. Those mothballs shouldn't get to keep all the secrets. This is the Mothball Prophecies.
Hello and welcome to the Mothball Prophecies. I'm Samantha Mashburn.
And I'm Spellcheck.
Spellcheck is filling in today for Jill because she is on a well-deserved vacation.
Very much needed.
And today we have the incredible honor of sitting down with an award-winning jeweler, artist, and taxidermist joining us from Victoria, Australia. Julia Deville is with us today. Welcome, Julia. Hi.
Hello. Hi. Thank you.
Oh, man. Please, the pleasure is all ours. I am very excited not only to talk about your work as an artist, but your journey to getting to that point. So thank you for sitting down with us today.
No, oh, you're welcome.
I'm really trying not to just freak out, honestly. I'm super excited about this.
It is. And I was excited that, you know, I of course love having Jill with me, but Spellcheck understands and gets the, not that Jill doesn't, but she understands and gets the side of taxidermy and the little more kind of, not necessarily strange, but out of normal collector's capacity of wrapping their heads around.
The macabre part of it, really.
Yeah.
Cool. Really, so, I love that.
We're very excited to nerd out with that with you. And it's always interesting when we book an interview with somebody that is so far ahead in the time zone of going, okay, when does this land for you and when does this land for us? So it actually worked perfectly that we moved it back a week because Jill and I were traveling last week and we would have been getting home and then sitting down. So this is great.
Yeah. Great.
And you guys are heading into summer now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Spring now.
Oh,
so yeah, lovely.
I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah. And is this your first springtime in your new house in Australia?
Yeah. So I started renovating a year ago, but I didn't move in until before Christmas. So yeah, it's my first spring living here.
I'm excited to see what like flora and fauna comes up for you in this new place.
Oh, it's amazing. It's like it's bursting with camellias and rhododendrons and azaleas. And yeah, it's just like, it's gorgeous.
Oh my gosh.
It's a very, where I live is a very beautiful part of Victoria. It's up in the Dandenong Ranges. So
wow.
Yeah, there's a lot of European gardens here and it rains a lot. So everything's quite fertile and lush. Oh. It's definitely not your typical Australian setting.
And you're originally from New Zealand?
Yeah,
so
yeah, from Wellington.
What's the weather difference like? I don't really know the climates of either of those places besides
Melbourne's
hot.
Yeah, so Melbourne's, it's fairly similar to New Zealand. It just gets hotter. Yeah, it's a bit hotter in summer. So, you know, New Zealand, you're kind of, in Wellington, you're lucky if it pushes 27 degrees Celsius in the summer. And then, yeah, Australia's, you know, we'll get up into the 40s.
Oh,
so
geez.
Wow.
Melbourne, I mean, yeah.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah.
That could. We get quite warm here too, similar to that. It's a high desert region that we live in here too, similar to Melbourne.
Yeah.
And so I want to talk a little bit about your childhood. I was doing some research today and you began your collecting as a child, right?
Yeah.
What were some of the first things that you were finding and collecting?
So my dad was in property, and so he was doing a lot of demolition work, and he would take me to construction sites, and, you know, we'd always find all sorts of strange things in buildings that were being demolished. And he would take me antiquing and junk shops and stuff like that. But we actually would, when we were renovating our house when I was growing up, and we were digging into the bank, we found a lot of like really interesting antique bottles and even like, I don't know if you've seen them before, but toothpaste containers used to be these beautiful porcelain square kind of boxes that had like gold leaf writing and they were so ornate. So we found one of those and yeah, I guess I was kind of just around that sort of energy with my dad. So
yeah,
it started very young.
Did your parents have particular items that they always were adding to their collections?
I'm trying to think. Like my dad, more so as he got older, like he was often, you know, his house has bits off historical buildings and that sort of thing. So he's got, you know, he has a lot of very eclectic, interesting, and he's a mixture of kind of modern and antique. And I guess Mum is as well. Like, yeah, she's got a lot of very modern stuff, but then some beautiful antiques as well.
Yeah. That's how I grew up too, was kind of that breadth of collecting. If it was just like, you just brought interesting pieces home, it wasn't necessarily because of the item's acclaim.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I love the idea that you got to go through old buildings. That's something I love doing if I ever get the chance.
Yeah, yeah, it was amazing. Well, you know, it seemed normal because it was just what we did. But yeah. Yeah, I remember finding like an old Judy doll from a Judy and Punch show, and yeah, all sorts of things. Dad actually got a Creature from the Black Lagoon pinball machine out of one of his buildings once, which I used to. Well, we had it at home, and then when I moved to Australia. And they moved house, they just chucked it out. And I was like, do you realize how much those things are worth?
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Probably worth about 30 grand or something.
Did you find any, like, cool stuff inside walls, too?
Not that I can remember. I did in my last house, found some, like, old photos and stuff on the floor, but nothing really exciting.
We had that same thing growing up where, I don't know if they have them in Australia, but we have, like, dump areas where people take their household garbage.
Yeah.
And so we had one where I grew up was really rural. And so you drove literally out into the middle of nowhere. And at the time you could like get out and go through everything. So it was like a family dump trip and we'd all bail out of the car. And my mom would be like, no stuffed animals, no this, no that. And so I literally felt like a treasure hunter looking through stuff.
Wow.
It's like dumpster diving for American for hillbillies.
Yeah. Yeah, similar.
Yeah, my dad used to take us to the dump as well, but we called it the rat pack, and it wasn't actually to go looking for things. We'd go at nighttime and put the lights on, and it was just crawling with rats, and that was like a fun outing.
I love that.
Where I live, we do not have rats, but we have lots and lots of mice and rattlesnakes, so I'm assuming.
Oh, wow.
Because the transfer station, that's what they call it here, is a transfer station, and it was called the rattlesnake transfer station because of that, which sounds terrifying now. But now you can't really do that. And now I just get the thrill of like maybe driving by a thrift store and seeing something left by the garbage.
Or people here will leave stuff out on the sidewalk and put a little sign that says free.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have hard rubbish here. So like once or twice a year, everyone leaves all of their stuff out on the road. And
really?
Yeah. And so it's like the streets are just full of, and you know, I've got friends who have found beautiful pieces of antique furniture and stuff. Yeah. There's a lot of crap, but it's
oh, that's incredible.
That sounds so awesome.
Because and your dad was naturally curious from doing he was a scuba diver by trade. Did he do that by trade or did he do that for fun?
No, that was just his hobby. Still is.
And I would love nothing more than if my dad brought me home things from anywhere that was like dead or something like that, because what a wonderful thing to be introduced to animals that way and sea life.
Yeah, no, I just remember playing with like an octopus that he brought home once. It all seems kind of cruel now, but you know, when I was little, I didn't really get any of that it was quite awful for the octopus to be out of the water. But yeah, it was still alive and, you know, like having its tentacles like wrapping up my arm and stuff.
Yeah.
Very beautiful.
It's an interesting feeling. We went to Mexico when I was in high school and we were looking around snorkeling in the coral and there was an octopus hiding in a hole. And I was like, I got to look at that. And I put my hand down and it put its tentacles up my arm and then I pulled it off. And for 3 weeks I had circles on the back of my hand. Cause we are not by an ocean by any means. We're in Idaho.
We are landlocked.
So when the first experience I had with the ocean was incredible because it's just teeming with. And I was a curious child like you were, and I was struck by your first incidents with like taxidermy or a preserved animal with your grandmother's fur stoles.
Yeah. So I don't know if they got, we had a bunch of her fox stoles. So, you know, it was the ones where the mouth opens up and like bites onto the tail and it had the legs and everything on it. And I was fascinated by them. Like I used to kind of dress up in them and I thought that because they looked real, you know, they didn't look real, but they had like this kind of feeling of being alive. And I always felt like that would come to life when I wasn't looking. And it was, I guess it was, you know, I was probably 4 or 5 when I was playing with those. So it was a very early intro.
Yeah. I think, you know, where we live, it's primarily, and which I wanted to talk to you a little bit about too, and we'll get into it a little bit later with your taxidermy. Where we live, I have a problem with people's taxidermy that is traditionally for the show of having the taxidermy piece. Like we live in a heavily populated hunter area. So the taxidermy you see is generally large, like elk, deer, moose, bear. And then you have some people, of course, that travel and do big game hunting. And that's where I kind of draw the line on taxidermy itself is like, And I know you align with that too. And like I said, we'll get into that. But that was something we were always introduced to. And then when I started to see, as I got older, and like the first time I saw your work, I was like, oh, there's a side to taxidermy that isn't terrible as it is here where we live. Because where I live, when I walk in and see somebody's big game, it's not fascinating to me.
It's really just the hyper masculine. I shot this big giant thing and I didn't use any of the rest of it. I just shot it so I could put it on my wall. That's what taxidermy here is.
I find that very upsetting. I actually have done a few pieces referencing that. So I've done a piece called Gun Club, which is like a little mouse on a shield. It was a brooch, like a trophy mounted mouse. And I've also done a kitten trophy rug. So like, you know, like you would have a bear rug, but it's made from a kitten. And it's kind of a comment on like, it's meant to be, hunting is meant to be this like big masculine thing. It's like, look what I killed. But it's like, you shot it with a gun from a distance. Like, it's not like you wrestled it with your bare hands. It's kind of like no more powerful than shooting a kitten and making a rug out of that.
And I love that about your art specifically, is that the evoking of that type of conversation around the pieces of taxidermy and why somebody has it displayed or why they've put it. And I like that you actively challenge those perceptions of taxidermy. But I wanted to talk about something that made me giggle because it's similar to, so we have a shared love for the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yes.
I was definitely a strange kid with strange things. And I had a lot of the same feelings you had the first time you saw it. And we were close to the same age of witnessing that spectacle.
I really think that's super like telling about your personality.
Yeah.
And maybe about the parents as well. Yeah. I don't know. I still don't know why my mum let me watch that at that age. Me and my sister were like dancing around the house singing, "I'm just a sweet transvestite."
Yes. And yeah, and I remember the same thing. My mom was a single parent. So I think it was just kind of like, if you're in front of the TV, it's going to be better for everybody for a little bit. But that was like my first instance of like seeing drag, which I love drag, and seeing just, I mean, and I'm a musical person too. I love musicals. So it was like, oh, this is a thing too. And it's not just all Joseph in the Technicolor Dreamcoat, which all my friends talk about. What in you like shifted when you started to see that iconography growing up?
I don't know. There was just something that resonated with me. Like, I loved the costumes and like Frankie. The idea of things being so unconventional, and I guess I've always been different, and it was kind of like, these are my people or something, you know, like, I love magenta and I just love everything about it. I love the fact that it's made by a New Zealander, you know, like,
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, no, Richard O'Brien's a Kiwi, the guy who plays Riff Raff, he wrote it. And I didn't know that at the time, but yeah, it was weird. It was on a more visceral level though. Like, I'm having trouble to even find the words for it, because it just like struck a chord somewhere in me. I've seen that film so many times and I've performed it. Like, I used to be a roller skater when I was a kid and into, you know, competition skating, and I did my routine to the Time Warp. Somehow I managed to convince my jazz ballet teacher to let us do our end of year show to the Time Warp, and I went to a private girls school, and in our second to last year, part of house music, you would do there would be a small group performance at like maybe up to 10 of the 16-year-olds would do like choreograph and perform mm-hmm. a song, and somehow I got involved in that and pushed it towards the Rocky Horror Show. And this was, you know, like a very religious,
I was just about to
posh
ask
school, and we were wearing like corsets, knickers, fishnets with our faces painted and our hair teased up, and none of us could sing, and we were all just kind of trotting around the stage screaming, and all we had accompanying us was a piano. And we got a standing ovation from the whole school, and we came last because the judge was a hymn writer.
Oh,
and
no.
And I think we had to go to the principal's office after.
Well, it was to the Time Warp, right? So it was a piano version of the Time Warp.
The Time Warp, yeah. It was very interesting.
I think you need to be sainted.
Yeah.
For that.
They
alone.
Need to write a hymn about you. Yes. The hymn writer to this day has a track buried somewhere of those 10 girls.
Wow. So when you say private school, is that term used in the same way in New Zealand as in the States, where it's a school like you would pay tuition to go to?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was
like in the UK, private is the same as a public school here. And I'm
private is a paid school and normally very like stuck up.
Mm-hmm.
And,
oh, okay.
Yeah. And, you know, like it was an all girls school and it was very strict and
conservative.
Conservative, yeah, that's the word I was looking for. Yeah. So, and which didn't suit me at all. My parents ended up pulling me out for my last year of school because I wanted to do 4 art subjects and 2 sciences. And the private schools obviously want to get good marks, mm-hmm. and it's really hard to get marks in the arts. And I was good at maths and science, so they wanted me to do all of those subjects.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the end, I ended up doing, I think, physics, chemistry, painting, design, fashion and textile photography.
Oh, wow.
And I think I just barely passed all of my art subject, and then I got like A's in physics and chemistry because it's easy to get high marks in those subjects if you understand it. Mm-hmm. Art is subjective, and I don't like that it was so kind of formulaic, and you had to paint for our bursary, like last year portfolio, we were painting like 1970s concrete buildings, and that's what we had to do. We were given that as our brief, and I liked doing figurative form, so I was putting these kind of white ghosty figures in the front.
Oh, wow.
Which I don't think went down too well because I wasn't doing what I was meant to be doing. But yeah, you don't get points for creativity and art at school.
Yeah, and you're the second person I've heard of that instance of going to a private school, wanting to specialize in something, and the school being like, no, we need to continue getting money for students being sent here. And I just think that's for the parents that send their kids to private school for whatever reason, I think that's a very important thing to keep in mind is, you know, is academia more important to you or is the creativity of your child more important? And so good on your parents for...
Well, my dad's very eccentric and he used to, like we were only allowed one earring in each earlobe and I had a whole bunch of piercings and I had my tongue pierced 3 times and all of this stuff, and Dad would just call up the principal and yell at her and say, she's our daughter, we mm-hmm. decide whether she's allowed piercings or not, like we negotiated this mm-hmm. and came to a deal, and so I was the only person who was allowed to, I had to wear band-aids over my earrings and a plastic tongue pierce, like plastic things in my tongue so they couldn't see it. But yeah, he was constantly kind of at them, and then they were more than happy to pull me out when the school wouldn't allow me to do the subject.
I love that he went to bat for you like that. That is fantastic.
Yeah. I was lucky.
Yeah, I had a very similar. I didn't go to a private school. I went to a public school, but the area that I'm from is very conservative, and my family was not in alignment of that theology. And so I also had piercings at a very early age. I had my Monroe pierced at like 15, my belly button at 13. So I had a lot of those same things too, of people like quizzing my mother about this, you know, and the thing is that people do is they attribute all of these adult stereotypes to body modification and like sexualizing girls, especially that have body modification at that age. And it was, it was the same kind of thing. My mom was like, it doesn't matter. It's just a piercing. It's not.
Yeah.
It doesn't do anything.
It grows over. You can take it out. It's not like I was like, I do have face tattoos now, but it's not like I was tattooing my face back then and they were allowing me to do things that you can't come back from.
Yeah. You know? And I don't know if your parents were like my parents. My mom was like, well, either I'm going to take her to do it or it's going to happen regardless.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, I find that interesting because at the time when I was getting pierced, I was just like, this is great. And it was like another stepping stone. And now I don't have really any of those piercings left at all, except for my ears and my nose. No,
I've taken all of mine out completely.
Yeah. I was just like,
yeah, you get over it. Mm-hmm. Once you've, like, I think that's the thing. It's just getting it out of your system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then just, yeah, moving on from that. Yeah. So I also just got tired of getting them caught on things in my life because that's never fun either.
Yeah.
That's not a good idea. And so you finished school and did you immediately go to university and start studying art? Is that what your next step?
Yeah. I did a year of fashion in New Zealand and I hated it. It just wasn't what I thought it would be. I'd always wanted to be a fashion designer and I could just see it would be such a long time before I got to make anything I wanted to wear.
Mm-hmm.
So then I moved to Melbourne when I was 18 and did a year of shoemaking, maybe a year and a half of shoemaking. Again, same thing. Thought I wanted to be a shoe designer and realized it was going to be so long before I could make any shoes that I wanted. And mm-hmm. so after a year and a half of that, I did a couple of short jewelry courses. And like the first day of the first course, I just knew that's what I wanted to do. And it was the same time I had found my taxidermy mentor.
Rudy, right? Was his name?
Yeah.
Rudy?
Yeah.
That is incredible that because I know you were looking for quite some time to find somebody that could teach you taxidermy, right?
Yeah. I first realized taxidermy was something you could do when I must have been 15 or 16 and I bought an 8-pointer stag's head from an antique shop.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh, you know, that's kind of when I put two and two together. I knew of taxidermy, but I just never thought about it before then.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wanted to learn how to do it. So I kind of found some taxidermists and, it's very male dominated or was very male dominated industry back then. And none of them would really take a 16-year-old girl
mm-hmm.
seriously. And it wasn't until I moved to Melbourne and there was this amazing shop called Wunderkammer. It's actually still around, but it's a different person owns it now. But back then it was owned by these two friends, Heather and Igor. And
Igor.
They were amazing. Both of them were artists and it was this, like, it looked like an old Victorian science lab and they sold like human skeletons and antique medical equipment and some taxidermy. They were both vegan and I just spent a lot of time there. And Heather was friends with Rudy's son who is an acrobat, and so they of kind course. Of introduced me and Rudy offered to teach me, and it was a very kind of beautiful learning experience. Yeah.
Like the perfect serendipitous, right, lacing of ties.
Yeah. Yeah. And Rudy is such an amazing man. Like, again, he'd worked for museums most of his life and he was into taxidermy for the preservation side of it. And he had his own business and he did do some like game, he had to do a lot of foxes that people would hunt, but it was never what he wanted to do. Like, he just loved the creativity and, he's Dutch and my family, half my mum's side of the family is Dutch. And I just resonated with him.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And he just I was 18 and he was probably in his 60s and we just got on so well. Like, I felt more comfortable with him than I did with a lot of people my own age.
Yeah.
And it was just such a lovely experience.
I just think it's just a beautiful love story of I'm sure he was just like chuffed to bits to teach somebody.
Especially. Yeah, I think he was just happy that, because back then taxidermy was creepy. Like, mm-hmm. I would tell, before I found my teacher, I would tell people that I wanted to learn taxidermy and I would literally have people like mid conversation turn around and walk away because it was just so bizarre. Like, it's not like now when it's kind of fashionable and every cool bar has a piece of taxidermy mm-hmm. in it. It was considered really weird. And so Rudy was just stoked that, like, this young girl was interested in the craft and he was so happy to teach me.
Is taxidermy kind of readily available for people to see where you grew up and where you are now? Because here you get taxidermy in every Walmart and everybody's mm-hmm. house has something. I mean, it's all over the place.
More so now, but it's like fashionable, you know, like back then, no. Back then you just would see it in some dusty old antique shop or something.
Yeah.
That was kind of, you know, and maybe in like if you went skiing in the lodge or something,
mm-hmm. okay,
might
yeah.
be some, but yeah, definitely not in people's houses or anything. Yeah.
Everybody's house here has yeah, something.
Everybody.
Yeah, wow.
Was it considered just really too macabre and taboo for people to own taxidermy then?
Yeah, I think it was just like people thought it was weird. I think yeah. it was just kind of associated with serial killers and mm-hmm. I don't know what yeah. else, but there was, you know, like it was definitely not something like, I was the only person I knew in my life that had a piece of taxidermy
yeah.
with when I bought my stag's head. And yeah,
I think it's more unusual here for someone to not have.
Right. But I think like Idaho and some northern states are an outlier in that.
Yeah. Of, yeah. Let's yeah. specify yeah. Idaho. Yeah. There's a lot of hunting yeah. that goes around, goes yeah. on here. Yeah.
But like nobody in my family growing up had taxidermy. I don't come from a family of hunters.
I do.
Yeah. So it was not something that was in our house growing up. But I have to imagine that your jewelry design and your taxidermy gives you a unique eye for detail when processing an animal.
Yeah I think I just naturally have an eye for detail anyway. I think that's why I was so why I just loved jewelry straight away. I was, you know, basically percentages of a millimeter are important mm-hmm. and I was like, that's my thing, like I love that, like specificity and attention to detail.
Yeah. And what were some of your early pieces? Like, what did Rudy teach you on in becoming a taxidermist?
And also be super specific. I want to know the process.
Yeah. Okay. So the first time I went to see him, I just went to meet with him and he kind of explained the process to me and showed me some things he'd done. And then he was like, when you find something, bring it out and I'll teach you how to do it. So a few weeks later, my housemate came home drunk and she'd found a dead starling on the side of the road. So I went out, I took that out to Rudy. I was really nervous because I didn't know if I'd be able to stomach it or not. You know, mm. I didn't know what was involved and mm. I really wanted to do it, but I was like, I might not be able to cope with this.
Yeah.
And we got there and he kind of would show me on one side and then I would do the other side. And it was so beautiful. It was just like this very clean, you know, it was a fresh bird. It had been in the freezer. This delicate process mm-hmm. and you know, once you remove the skin, so you skin it first and the body is just like a chicken's body, you know, it's all very familiar and you're not breaking the carcass open and you're not dealing with guts and mm-hmm. there's not a lot of blood or anything and it's mm-hmm. all very clean. And yeah, so he would just do one side and I would do the other side. And I think we posed it. I wonder where it is actually. I should find out where that piece is. Since I've moved, I forgot I had that. A lot of my early pieces got ravaged by moths, so they're gone now. But yeah, we just posed it on a branch and it hangs on the wall. You know, it was very traditional.
Mm-hmm.
The next piece I did was a parrot that I found, and we actually were planning on eating the parrot as well because he really wanted to show me like the idea of using the whole animal, mm-hmm. but we didn't have time. And he said that parrots don't taste that nice anyway. It was more going to be like the ritual of doing that. But that one was done flying and I had it hanging from the ceiling.
Wow.
And then the next piece I did was a fox. So I called him up and I said I had a fox and he was like, don't you bring that disgusting thing anywhere near me.
Oh no.
Apparently he was like, foxes are the smelliest, most revolting thing. And apparently they have this anal gland that has some horrific scent that comes out and you can't, once you get it on you, you can't get it off.
Like a skunk?
And I guess probably not as bad as a skunk, but I think it's
still pretty horrific.
Similar.
Bad enough that he didn't want me to bring like, it out.
Absolutely and not, then, Julia.
And then he called back and he was like, oh, look, just bring the head out and we'll do the head. So nice. I was like, okay. So I'm outside with a hacksaw, like sawing this fox's head off in my pajamas, and my housemate comes out and was just like, oh God.
That would not have been weird here.
Yeah. But that would have been weird to me. I would have walked outside and been like, who's my roommate?
I did have some issues with I had some kittens in the freezer. My housemate had a cat. And she didn't get it de-sexed, and it kept having kittens, and some of them would die. And so I had the kittens in the freezer that I was going to taxidermy. And one day I went to look for it, and it was gone. Hmm. And I was like, where are the kittens gone? And Ruben had found them in an ice cream container and then got really annoyed and buried them in the garden. And I was furious. I was like, A, why are you opening my ice cream container?
Yeah, it's my ice cream anyways, Ruben. Get out.
And then I went around the garden with a pair of chopsticks trying to find where it was, but then it turned out he'd thrown them out in the bin.
Oh, Ruben.
Yeah. Ruben's still a dear friend now, but it was not his best moment.
I oddly enough had a similar experience. I had found, birds fly into windows often, and I was at my in-law's house, and there was a beautiful bird on the ground. And as any logical person does, I went, I'm going to take that home and put it in my freezer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of my friends was over, and she was, do you have anything to eat? And I was like, well, I guess you can check. And she was in the freezer, and she goes, Sam. And I'm like, yeah. She goes, why specifically do you have a bird in a Ziploc bag in your freezer? And I was like, oh, I think I'm going to try and learn how to taxidermy it. And she was just like,
was this your oldest friend that I went to high school
with? No, it was Marky, the girl I work with now. She knows her. But yeah, it was very much like, I didn't, like you, I hadn't thought anything of it. I was like, well, I'll get to it when I get to it. But
yeah, as I got older, and I ended up getting a dedicated freezer. But yeah.
Smart. Yeah. Very smart.
I had a biology teacher in high school who was also like a vulture. And there was one room, he had the biggest room in the classroom. And the one room in the back was literally filled with handmade jars of things. And then he had a fridge and freezer specifically for specimens that somebody had brought him or he found. So he would be like, can you go in the freezer? And on this shelf, there should be a snake. And we're like, he's like, just bring it out to me. He was quite an eccentric man. And I loved him dearly for that.
That was amazing.
It was, and that was when I started to be like, oh, okay, people do just have dead things, and that's okay. And then people are like, yeah. No, people don't have dead things. I'm like, oh, well, fine, whatever.
So my uncle, when I was younger, he was a wildlife biologist and worked with a forest service, and he was working on his PhD, and it involved something with rats and smaller animals, and he had a license to pick up roadkill for his studies, and so... he would occasionally send weird animal parts to my dad for me and my brother. Like, hey, look, here's a fox skull. Or here, look at this picture of your uncle with a dead rat or whatever. So it took me a while to figure out that that wasn't usual. Because there was always something in our house that was used to be alive.
Yeah, right. Well, and I wanted to ask you too, because there's an interesting fact about you that some people might find interesting, that you are a taxidermist and also a lifelong vegetarian and then vegan.
Yes, but actually not at the moment. So I became vegetarian when I was 12 after an experience on a farm, my uncle's farm. And then I was kind of not a very good vegetarian because I didn't like vegetables. And, you know, this was like back in the early 90s. Like,
yeah, there was
wasn't
nothing.
Much. My mum had to go to the library and get books about vegetarian cooking, and it was all like tofu and, you know, that sort of thing, which I didn't really like. So I would go in and out of anemia and then kind of have doctors talking me into eating meat again. And then I became a very strict vegetarian when I moved to Melbourne, and then became vegan, and then had some health stuff happen, I think partially as a result of that, and also some burnout and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I now, I wouldn't really say I'm anything. Like, I eat a little bit of fish, I eat eggs if they're, you know, ethically sourced and stuff. And I will sometimes make bone broth.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like, you know, it's using byproducts more than main things. But yeah, it was easier when I was vegan, because when I got death threats and hate mail and stuff, it was kind of like an easy card to pull. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because there is still a big part of that community that it didn't matter if you were vegan or mm-hmm. if the work was like helping animals, mm-hmm. it was still, you know, there would still be a line that they could find like, oh, well, the animal didn't give you permission and, mm-hmm. you know, like its soul and all of that stuff. Yeah. So I wouldn't do it if I believed I was doing anything to the animal's soul. Like it's. Yeah.
And I want to say I find it incredibly commendable that you were, you know, living in that lifestyle for such a long time and recognized for your health, finding a way to still respect the things that you are consuming and be conscious of that. I think more people should, where we live, it's rural and there's lots of farming, right? I think more people should be conscious about the things they're consuming and how they are brought to your table.
Yeah, where it comes from.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're so disconnected, you know, mm-hmm. like meat comes in a polystyrene tray with Glad wrap mm-hmm. over the top. Like you don't, you're just not familiar with that side of things. Mm-hmm. And yeah, for me, the work was never about trying to convince people to go vegan or vegetarian. It was more getting people to make informed decisions, like to make the decisions they would make if they were presented mm-hmm. with all of the information. And yeah. that was what I found the most powerful part of doing the work.
I love that.
Yeah. And that was one of the very first things that drew me to your work when I first discovered it, was seeing taxidermy in a way that made me think about the animal and its journey and where it got to, and then the way you beautifully encrust them. And I love that all of your work has such a sense of innocence and fragility to it while still being taxidermy. And
yeah, for me, it's about celebrating the animal. Mm-hmm. So it was always, you know, I didn't want to do things that were shocking or grotesque. Like I wanted to show the beauty. And even if it's, you know, things like a pigeon, which people just think of as a flying rat, but when you look at it, it's actually a beautiful bird. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just common, so you don't pay attention. And the same as a mouse and a rat. And mm-hmm. I actually had one woman buy a piece that was a rat curled up on an antique, like a beautiful pink kind of floral antique plate.
Oh, wow.
And it had black diamond eyes and I think some gold leaf, like a gold leaf kind of curling around it. Oh. And she paid I think $4,500 for it at the wow. time, and she was saying that morning she'd just thrown a rat in the rubbish bin that she'd poisoned.
Oh.
And that idea of kind of preciousness, it's like, you know, like how we value things and mm-hmm. what is valuable and what is precious. Mm-hmm. And to get people to think about their ideas around those things, I find really interesting.
I like that you're taking the focus away from the hunter who is being commended for mm-hmm. what they've done and the animal's just the afterthought. Mm-hmm. Whereas what you're doing, it's all about the animal. Mm-hmm. And doesn't really have anything to do with the person involved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's, for me, it's, there's something sacred about animals. Like mm-hmm. I think I've always been very drawn to animals from a young age and felt an affinity to them. And there is that, you know, like you were saying, that innocence about them. Like they don't judge you. They don't hurt you in an emotional way, like they are quite pure. It's like everything they do is instinctual and for survival, whereas we've kind of developed these things that are outside of our nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And because I know when you begin the process of creating a piece, it's very free form, correct?
Mm.
Do you feel like the piece you're working on guides you to its own story and the naming of a piece when you're starting it?
Yeah, in a very, like, kind of flow process. Like, normally, it does go, like, sometimes I have an idea and then I work to the idea, but a lot of the time with the taxidermy, I would just have the animal and I would just start posing it the way that it felt like it wanted to be mm-hmm. posed, and then I would decorate it after that. But then there have been bigger pieces I've done, like the giraffe that I did a couple of years ago was about a 10-year process.
Wow.
From start to finish, mm-hmm. because first I found out it was in the museum of a freezer, and then I harassed them for several years to sell it to me, and it took them a few years to agree, and then it had, like, then I finally went and posed it, but we had to freeze dry it because it had been in the freezer for 30 years. Wow. So it was too deteriorated to taxidermy. Mm. And so freeze drying kind of dictated that it had to be lying down because it wasn't going to fit standing up in the freeze dryer. And then once I had the posed giraffe, then there was a lot of kind of planning around and designing and stuff like that, and then working on it. But I think when it's working on something that big, you can't really afford to fudge around with it because you will, it's expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it was such an expensive piece to make, and I'm using gold and diamonds and things like that. So it was very planned out in a sense. And then there's been other pieces where it's like I'll be doing a lamb and it's got a bit of a patch of fur missing on the side. Mm. So then I'll kind of shape that patch and fill it with rubies, and then it looks like a wound, and then mm-hmm. it gets put on a platter, and it's kind of, you know, there's, yeah, it works both ways, but there's always a feeling of like, just there's just a way that the each animal should be posed, mm-hmm. and that's a very intuitive thing.
That giraffe piece makes me like almost want to weep because it's the innocent, you can feel the life, and because it was a stillborn giraffe, right?
Yeah, it was stillborn in a zoo.
It just, the emotion that's in that piece, and even I think that the laying down works perfectly for it because
yeah.
it shows that the only reason it was in that situation was because of man, really.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I presented it in a big kind of glass vitrine, like it's, you know, it's very much out of nature mm-hmm. and it's got the reins and the harness mm-hmm. on it. You know, it's like, again, like the way man harnesses animals for its own use. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was it preserved at all before being put in the freezer?
No, it was just, wow. I think its organs had already been removed. Like they were obviously intending to taxidermy it at some yeah. point, but, you know, 30 years on, it just... Well, and I think they had actually had the freezers break down once or twice and had to hire a, you know, a mobile freezer and almost lost it. And that's the point that they decided to sell it to me because I think they just realized it's like they may as well get some money for it. Otherwise, it will probably end up going.
My other favorite piece that I always, it's the first piece I talk about whenever somebody asks, like when I mention your name, which is often. And I mentioned there's a piece that always struck me as, and I don't know how you intended it. I don't know that I've ever done any research on your beings behind it. It's the lamb that's on top of a silver platter with the rubies in the neck and the like holder, the handle on the back of it.
Yeah. Yeah. The cloche handle.
That piece, the first time I saw it was, it's that one right there at the top. That first, I went, this is such a representation of the food industry for this animal, and the industry that this animal exists in is just literally to be put on this platter and presented.
But without any identification with it being an animal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is beautiful. Yeah. I haven't seen this before. I'm sorry. This is,
that the, is that the white lamb?
Yeah, the it, white lamb. Yeah. That one. Yeah, that's the one I pointed out because that was my, oh, she knows.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, the first time I, what's its name? Sorry. What was the name?
Silence.
Wow. It's just your work is incredibly evocative in that, in when I view it, at least when I look at it, I just am always kind of stunned into the silence at not only the beauty, but the story that your pieces are telling.
Your pieces are so connected and so honoring of the spirit of the animal. Mm-hmm. And for me, that brings a lot of emotion up, mm-hmm. like looking at your pieces, it's obvious that you're not, that you're putting part of yourself, but you're also, I'm even having trouble. Mm-hmm. This is just so beautiful. And for it's like touching a part of the mm-hmm. inside of me, mm-hmm. if that's not thank too you. Weird to say.
Yeah. No, that's lovely. That means a lot. Thank you.
The way that you treat them is, it just is obviously very gentle and kind and mm-hmm. hugely meaningful.
Yeah, there's, like, I always call them my animals. Like, there's a connection to them and there's a sense of reverence. And
yes.
it's interesting because a lot of times I will get people say to me, oh, when I heard about your work, I thought it sounded revolting and terrifying. And sometimes even when they see photos, because, you know, the size is hard to tell, but I'd have people come up to me at exhibitions and just say, like, I cried when I saw this. Like, I thought I would be really confronted and scared, but it's just so beautiful. And there's so, like, it would just emote so much. And I had this exhibition at the National Gallery of Victoria in 2013, and it was called Degustation. It was basically a dining room. So, you know, there were big Victorian tables and platters with animals, and I had artworks from the NGV's collection on the walls, and it was like black flocked velvet wallpaper and black velvet curtains to enter into the room. So it was very theatrical, and the, you know, there were people sitting the whole time, like guards and stuff and facilitators in there, and they just said it was like nothing they'd ever experienced. It was like a library, like people wouldn't talk in there, and like if they did, they were whispering, and there was like just this energy in the room. And yeah, I just, I didn't really understand the power of it until that exhibition, and that's when I started doing more immersive work, because I just realized how you could actually transport someone to this very emotive state by kind of surrounding them in that environment.
Yeah.
It was, that was an incredible exhibition. I remember seeing the photos of it and just being like, because I'd only ever seen bits and pieces of your work before.
But do you just know, like, everything about everybody?
It's a problem I really have. I'm just hyper interested in things.
Collecting information.
Yeah, yeah. Like a magpie. But that piece, and then that's when I started to kind of focus and follow your work a little more closely. And the next piece that had that same feeling to me was when you created the nursery.
And
that's one of the things I talk about with people too, is I talk about the mobile you created. I talk about the rocking horse. And was the alpaca in that?
Yeah, that rocking alpaca.
It's just, I mean, incredible.
Yeah, there is actually, there is an exhibition that I did in 2018 which had the giraffe in it, but it kind of brought it all together. So there was a dining room, there was the nursery or the bedroom, there was a room with the giraffe, and then I also, that's when I started going into learning how to make holograms. So there was a room of holograms as well of the works. And that I actually have, I 3D scanned the exhibition, so you can do a virtual walkthrough. So I can give you a link to
put in the show notes literally,
if you want.
Please, that sounds.
I feel giddy.
What a great. And this was also the place that you had. It was a multi-sense exhibit, right? There were smells and.
Yeah. Whoa. So there was music, a soundtrack for each room, which was like the bedroom had, you know, those jewelry box kind of clinky tunes. It was that, but it was a Nirvana song. And then the dining room, I'm trying to remember what the song was, but that was like a kind of piano version of, maybe that was the Nirvana song. There was like Nirvana, Smashing Pumpkins, like, so all of kind of my favorite rock bands, but done in different, like, you know, you kind of, so people would be like, this sounds really familiar, and then they'd realize it was like Smells Like Teen Spirit, but music box,
haunting, a little more haunting.
And then we had scents as well. Like, I really wanted, that was a harder thing to get right, and it didn't really work in the way I wanted it to, but I think for something like that you'd need to really work with someone. And it was getting to this point where I was, you know, it was already the biggest show I'd ever done. I was making holograms, you know, like it was getting 3D scanned. I was doing a virtual reality version. Like, it just got so kind of crazy that, yeah, the scent thing, I think we ended up just turning them off after a while. I can't even remember what scents I went with. I think it was like sage in the dining room. I wanted to do, in the hologram room, I wanted an ozone generator, because that's that really kind of technology smell, but apparently ozone's quite dangerous to breathe in. So the gallery was like, we're not going to do that.
And you're like, well, just give some gas masks out and let them experience it.
That idea of having a full sensory, like smells and sounds and looking, all of it, that just sounds so incredible.
Yeah, it was definitely like, I, you know, it kind of sounds weird to say because it was my own exhibition, but I loved going there. Like, I loved
I don't think that's weird at all.
Watching people's response. Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah, that is. Well, and I like that. I mean, of course, it's going to happen in the progression of your artistry, right? Where things get a little bit bigger and grander and you're able to put a little bit more symbolism.
More and more and more.
Into the things. And I wish we would have more time to talk about it, but I do want to get to your jewelry making too, because I also love that. And I love that you carry that same divinity, is how I would put it, for your jewelry making, because you specifically make, like, because you are very fond of memento mori, like I am. And these are like your version of sentiment jewelry, wouldn't you say, making wedding and engagement rings?
Yeah. Yeah. So like I do the full gamut of jewelry, but what I really am into now is the wedding and engagement rings. Like that's just the thing that if I could only do one thing for the rest of my life, that's what it would be. Mm-hmm. And like, I love everything about it. Like the fact that it starts with someone coming to you often because they want to propose. Mm-hmm. And so you're kind of working with them on what they want. And there's often a lot of symbolism in there. And then, you know, once they've proposed, then they're coming back getting wedding bands with the partner, and then it becomes this different dialogue. And then you kind of just know that these pieces are going to be passed down for generations, mm-hmm. potentially. And yeah, there's just so much meaning behind it. But I also do, you know, rings for other occasions as well. Like I do a lot of mourning rings, mm-hmm. for people. And I did one recently that was actually the most like emotive piece I've ever done personally. Her father died in a car accident, and she brought some of the glass chips from the windscreen that she wanted to get set into a ring. And like, you know, there'd been an email dialogue between my sales assistant and her, and you know, so I knew this was coming, and I kind of was like, yeah, I love the idea, I would definitely do that. When I actually got the bag of the glass, it was the most, like, I've been sent human, you know, hair from deceased people and mm-hmm. teeth and all sorts of things, and this, the most visceral response I've ever had was to this glass. Like it was just so powerful. And so yeah, they were set like diamonds into a ring, these little kind of like uncut diamonds, and it's one of the most beautiful things I think I've ever made. And it's you know, it's like the opposite of a precious gem. Like it's just windscreen glass, but then it's got this whole other level of preciousness about it. And you know, it's almost, you can almost feel the impact mm-hmm. in the glass.
That is it's so powerful that I sitting with that feeling, and to think of going through that motion of taking something that took probably her first love and turning it into something powerful for her to make, and to have you to make the beauty out of that situation for her.
Yeah definitely. It was, yeah, it still kind of gives me goosebumps thinking about it now, because it was, yeah, such an incredible, and I was just so grateful for her for coming to me with, you know, it was like such an honor to be able to be trusted with something like that.
Yeah. I wanted to know just a little bit about your process of, because you love the symbolism, what is a little bit of your process when you're asking somebody about the ring they're having made? Because I imagine it's different than a regular jeweler, right?
Yeah, well, my sales assistant does most of that stuff, and then I will come in with ideas. But normally the person has a pretty set idea on if they are wanting something thematic. Mm-hmm. You know, they kind of already know what direction they want to go. And like I did a ring for a guy who lived in somewhere in California, I think, and he was from... One of them was from California and the other one was from Australia. And I think we ended up doing like an eagle's wing on the side, because my assistant found that some people want very literal mm-hmm. symbolism. Mm-hmm. And I have to find a way for it to work in my work where it's not cliche and tacky, because mm-hmm. I'm not going to just randomly, like the other day I had someone emailing asking if I could do an elephant ring or engrave an elephant on the side, and I was just like, no, sorry, like, it's just not the sort of things I work with. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think the flag of wherever she was from had an eagle on it, so so I did like an eagle's wing down the side, and then it had, that's right, so she because she was Australian, so we did an Argyle diamond, which is from the Australian diamond mine, to symbolize that. And I think there was even some pink Argyle pink diamonds in there, which are very rare. The mine's actually just shut down. So, you know, you might get that level of something and like the windscreen glass, and then you'll get other people who just, you know, want, they just like the look of something, and they, they've seen something on the website and maybe they want it in rose gold with pink stones. Someone else wants it in black, plated metal with black diamonds. And yeah, it's a very varied thing.
It's that's like my holy grail, like top picks would be a piece of jewelry made by you and a piece of taxidermy. Like if I ever ended up with those things, I would retire. I would just literally never talk to anybody again.
You would tell everyone.
Literally wouldn't shut up about it. I would have like a QR code where I'd just pull up your website and be like, here, just go ahead and scroll. So nice.
She does kind of do that anyway, just to be honest.
It's my thing. It's my thing. Thank I always you. Like I've always been hyper interested in things since this whole show, like wanting to know why people are the way they
are. That's why the show is.
Yeah.
And yeah, those are my, I'm getting ready to celebrate my 10th wedding anniversary in the coming week. And I've been spinning the idea. I'm like, how many anniversaries do I need to have to convince my husband of this? I don't think it's many more.
Well, that's the thing. Like now people just make up what the anniversaries are, you know, like diamond used to be, I think, like 50 years or something, and then it got brought down to like 20 something because most people weren't making 50 years,
right? Yeah,
and people were wanting the diamonds sooner than that. So,
right, I should do like a 12 years and we became parents. Like, this is my anniversary gift for that because we made it through becoming parents. I have one more question before we get to two actually, because I want to know about Edith the ghost.
Yeah.
Have you had an experience with her yet, or are you still waiting in the wings?
Unfortunately, she's in a different part of the building to me, and I mainly work from home, especially now with COVID, so I don't spend that much time there, and I'm never there at night time, but it's in a beautiful, my showroom is in a beautiful Victorian terrace, and it's got a heritage overlay and everything, and so Edith was murdered by her partner in Victorian times. She was I think divorced, and so and then she had a lover, and she had two kids from her marriage, and she ran like a hostel or something, so it was like accommodation that she ran, and it got put through as a suicide. But it was that whole thing of like, you know, she was a hysterical woman. She was divorced. And basically, I think some of the people from the building ended up investigating it and even getting paranormal investigators out, because a lot of people have experienced her. But she shot herself, allegedly, she was right-handed. She shot herself with her left hand, and she missed the first time and shot her chin off, and then was successful the second time. But you would think that if you had shot your chin off, you might be having a bit of trouble to do the second shot, especially with your left hand.
And you would also probably be like, oh fuck, why did I do that? Like you would have like a small amount of,
And you know, this is all pre-forensics. Like now they would have just straight away been able to work it out. But yeah, I feel like she, and the part of the building that she was actually murdered in has been demolished, but I think they still do see her, and I think her body was brought into the front of the building, and
wow,
I love that.
God rest your soul, Edith.
Edie,
I love you. The second question I have, and you don't have to elaborate, I read in an article today that you donated your body to a museum in Germany. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I'm a donor for the Institute for Plastination in Germany. So it's that guy, Gunther von Hagens, who used to do the live dissections and stuff. He's pretty wacky. But I think I found out about it because there was a thing on the news like 20 years ago about how he was in trouble for using bodies that were not necessarily ethically sourced. Like I think prisoners ethically and stuff like that. Humans. And I was like, he needs donors. And I also just feel like I don't actually care what happens to my body when I die, but I feel like it's only fair that if I if I'm comfortable doing this to animals, that I should be comfortable to have the same thing done to me.
You should just have that as an auto response to your haters, to be like, actually, yeah, I'm also going to be a piece of taxidermy, so get out of here.
It doesn't matter what you say.
They just have to tell you how they feel.
Yeah, there is most of the vegan community are beautiful people that are doing it for compassionate reasons, mm-hmm, but there is a subset of angry people who are doing it because they're angry and they want to be angry at as mm-hmm many people as possible. And there's, it's meant to be about compassion, and sending someone death threats is not a compassionate, humans are animals too, and we need to be compassionate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All living things, not just the cute, fluffy ones.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Because it can be pretty aggressive, which I think is the common misnomer that people have for people that are vegan, is they just go, oh God, now this person's going to punch me right in the face.
Yeah.
For something. Yeah. Oh, thanks for answering those questions. Those were kind of my two things that I was like, I got to figure out if somebody just needed to add some words to their article or if that's really true. Before we get to today's estate sale walkthrough, Julia, where can our listeners find your work?
My jewelry is on my website, juliadeville.com. My art site is being rebuilt, but I've got Instagram. Mm-hmm. It's just at Julia Deville for the more art stuff, and at Julia Deville Bridal for the jewelry stuff. And yeah, I'll send you a link to exhibition walkthrough as well.
I'm excited. I'm so excited.
And also, you could quite literally just Google her, and Google just auto completes who you're looking for. Yeah. So
yeah,
there was a
drag
deal
queen actually called Julia Deville, and I have bumped her off.
Yeah, Google, sorry. Sorry, Julia. We of course will have everything listed for you in probably just a great amount of ways that I will find everything that I want to show of yours, because I just love your work so much. I cannot wait to share this with our listeners so that they can also appreciate the art that you make in both jewelry and taxidermy, literally.
Cute.
So those will be on our website, as well as linked on our Instagram at The Mothball Prophecies Original and themothballprophecies.com. And today we're going to get into my favorite part of the show. Jill is usually here and she does not like this part of the show.
I'm not going to complain in her place. I like this part.
So the estate sale walkthrough is a completely manufactured, made up walkthrough. The sale doesn't exist, but the items are very real. And I always find the biggest challenge and also thrill in writing this for people that specialize in a certain thing or have had access to large collections. So this was very fun to write. So the only rules are there will be two to three items listed in each section, and we will each pick one, and you can only pick one. It is your responsibility to find your own loopholes. I can't help you steal the other stuff from the sale. So, and these are based around items that I've either seen rolling around in your internet livelihood or the things you included in that questionnaire for me.
Okay.
Cool. I'm very excited. So today we are in your neck of the woods, picking from a museum curator's estate. They've come across some wonderful treasures in their time, and they have notable pieces. The first items we come to are laid out in a glass case and labeled with their price and their description. First, we have Queen Victoria's mourning jewelry commemorating her daughter Alice, specifically the enamel cross with the agate and pearls, and it says Alice written across it. Or we have Queen Victoria's mesh evening clutch that is shaped like a pig with diamond toes and ruby eyes.
Dude, I want the pig.
You want the pig? You're going.
I want that pig.
Yeah, I'm pretty into the pig. Mm-hmm.
Is that, and that's a real thing?
It's a real thing. And these, both of these pieces were released from the Monarchy's collection and sold through Sotheby's. So they are out in the private sector for collecting.
What's the price on the pig clutch?
I'm going to have to post a picture of it because
I'm looking it up right now.
Absolutely incredible. And it looks like something you would have created, quite honestly. It is that fine chainmail mesh.
Yeah.
With the gold pig head, and it's a side profile of the pig. And the ruby eyes, and it's got also a diamond smile.
this thing is amazing.
It's amazing.
I love Queen Victoria. I just think she's the coolest.
Is this what you meant?
Yes. But when we finish this, Julia, I'll pull it up so I can show you on the Zoom.
It's so good. It's so good.
So yeah, I also, we interviewed Hayden Peters on the show because of my love for the Victorian era. And I have right here behind me is a braid of hair from one of my dear friends. And upstairs I have hair pieces. So I fully align with the sentiment, and Memento Mori is a huge thing to me too. So whenever I find out somebody else is into it, I'm like, let's talk about this.
What are you picking?
I am going to specifically, I do love the pig, but I also love this brooch that was specifically made for Alice when she died at 35.
Does it have hair in it?
This one doesn't. She had a couple of pieces made for Alice, and they were gifted to her by Albert and different things like that, right? But this one specifically, it's all black with these beautiful little stones on the outside and then inlaid Alice. It's just a great classic, like, and the interesting thing too is as much symbolism as she was noted for having, it's very simple. It was a very simple piece given to her.
Good, because I would fight you for that pig.
We'll have to have shared custody. We'll split it between the three of us.
I will win.
All right. Now we have our treasures. Next, we visit the library that is filled with history and, of course, books. But we are specifically eyeballing the antique display pieces. So we are going to be choosing from a desktop. It's an antique miniature French enamel brevetté vitrine display.
That is.
Depicting. So vitrine is like glass on the outside. It's usually hand-painted.
And do you know what that is, Julia? Of course.
Sounds good. I'm already.
Or there is, and this can be used for a display case and not necessarily its original intent, an antique Victorian black cast iron plant terrarium with the stand. And it specifically has like a lot of the Gothic texture on the top, the spires and the different ornate detail. Which do you choose, Julia?
God, that's a hard one. I quite like the idea of the terrarium.
It's beautiful. I would. When I was writing this, I was set on the vitrine at first, right? And then I saw this terrarium and went, yeah, nope, it's going to be the terrarium for me, because it is, it sits on these beautiful little wispy cast iron legs, and it's just that full square glass facade. And it's just.
Terrarium is also one of my favorite words.
Oh,
I'm so glad you have a favorite word. That makes me so happy.
What about you, Spellcheck? What are you picking?
I don't know what a vitrine is, so I'm going to go with that cast iron. But also, how can cast iron be wispy?
It was so finely poured. Like, it really does. When you first look at it, it doesn't look. I'll show you that too. It does not look like cast iron. And the one I saw specifically had been restored. So the glass wasn't the leaded glass originally, which how epic would that be with the original leaded glass inside of it?
Amazing. I want something heavy enough that I can hit an intruder with it. So cast iron.
This is large, so you would have to maybe just shove them
is
into
it. Is it bigger than me?
Yes, it's quite large.
Okay.
Okay. The last item of business involves a little bit of time travel. So before we climb into Marty's DeLorean, we need to know, Julia, do you go back to the Victorian era to watch any jeweler of your choice create their pieces, or to the 18th century Japan to watch the making of netsukes? Where would you go?
No, I think I would have to go to the Victorian jewelers.
Oh, I thought I had you on that one.
I feel so unprepared. What is a netsuke?
A netsuke was ideally used before buttons, right? It was a little tiny piece you would wear either as a toggle or a decorative piece, and they were primarily carved out of ivory. Is that correct, Julia?
Yeah, I've got a couple of wooden ones and one ivory one. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know if I put that on the questionnaire, but Rudy makes them, my taxidermy teacher. He is like, he's highly collected in Japan for his
works.
And I bought one off him maybe 10 years ago. They're amazing. Like, my one's actually got a little pig in it as well. Like, his ones are these amazing worlds. So as you turn it around, it's like there's a pig, and then it turns into like a leg, and then there's like a little funny creature, and it's just like, he just carves with the knots of the wood.
Wow.
So, and there's like little mother of pearl inlays, and it's so detailed. And every time I look at it, I find something new in there. And, you know, there's like bits of bodies and all sorts of things. It's, so he had like a whole tray of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
How big are they normally to have that much detail? Like
an inch or two.
Yeah, they're teeny.
A tiny, yeah.
And they're done by hand? Well, I
we'll cover
all
it.
Hand carved. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We'll cover it in the curio corner.
Yeah.
But it was, well, they started originally in ivory and different like stones and things like that. And then as it moved, you know, centuries forward, they started to inlay more items into it, like ivory or a pearl and different things like that.
Yeah. The ones Dad's given me are all just like one thing. Like I've got a little apple that's got a little mouse crawling up the side.
Oh, and cute.
I've got a little bat, which is ivory, and that's like the wings kind of fold over. And what's the other one? Actually, no, maybe Rudy's one is my third. Yeah.
They're incredible. I hadn't heard of them until I got your questionnaire because you had it in there and I was like, what is this? And I looked it up and I was like, oh, damn.
So now you're an expert.
Now I have something else I need to look for. Or to even like if you see something out and about, right, and you can identify what that is.
What it is, yeah. Because they're very odd looking, like.
Yeah.
Wow.
They're incredible. I have one last question, then we'll let you go because you've given us an incredible amount of time. What is your favorite jewelry from the Victorian era? What is something when you see it, it really is, it says Julia to you?
I love the hair work. Like I've seen some, I have a piece that's quite amazing that is like hollow beads, which is woven from hair. And then it's got a crucifix, a hollow crucifix on the end. But I've seen more elaborate pieces that are like acorns that are like hollow acorns.
Yeah.
With just like this thin. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're amazing. I did at one point, I've got a book on hair work and I did start.
Is it the Mark Campbell
to learn
one?
How to, I'm not sure. It's purple.
I have a pattern book also cause I'm.
Yeah. And it just, And I got as far as doing a black and white checkerboard of hair, but that took so long on its own. So yeah, the getting to the hollow forms, I think it's kind of a lifetime practice.
And
got enough other things I need to do.
Yeah, we had somebody on the show that we spoke to that makes modern day mourning jewelry, and she is incredible. Her name's Gina Icavelli. And she does all of that, the table work and the palette work. And
incredible.
The only piece I own, because I'm pretty particular about my collection when it comes to hair pieces, because I'm a hairdresser by trade. And hair does not gross me out at all. And seeing hair pieces is incredible. But I have a piece, it's a 52-inch chain. And the chain is around the size, if you were to wrap it around the inside ink cartridge of a ballpoint pen. And it's a 3-strand braid and you cannot see where it begins or ends. And it's a links of that.
Yeah, it's links of hair chain. It is incredible.
And it looks like bronze. When I first got it, I was like, I've been had. This is just cheap chain.
I thought she was lying when she first showed it to me because it did not look like hair work.
Yeah. Same. It's incredible. So I would go back to the Victorian England and seriously just sit like a cat in a shop and watch somebody work.
Yeah.
I think I'd go to Victorian era for sure, but I wouldn't watch the jewelry. I'd go find Charles Dickens probably. Sorry, guys.
Charles, what's going on?
Hey,
I miss you. You could find him in a shop probably at some point.
He was a real dick, so I just want to go punch him in the balls.
Well, Juliet, thank you so much for sitting down with us today and sharing about your work. It was really a treat.
Awesome.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
We're both still trying to control ourselves.
Yeah. We'll probably lose it after we get off the call here.
Yeah.
To hear even more about the things we covered today in Julia's episode, stick around for this week's Curio Corner. I have to start by saying thank you for being such a wonderful counterpart in that interview.
Oh, hey, thanks.
Jill will be most proud of you.
Oh, well, I definitely can't replace her, but I'm happy to stand in.
It was quite nice to have you here by my side for that interview and to have like a little bit of a different perspective through it all. Also, it was nice.
Yeah, I like that I got to be, I felt like I was a lot more active than I anticipated.
You did great.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a little nerve-wracking to be a host.
Well, and it's an interesting perspective to be into. Like when we finished, I said, it's interesting to have a conversation over Zoom because the normal cadences of conversation really aren't.
Oh, yeah, it's completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't really notice that until you're having a longer conversation with someone.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more pausing. There's a lot more consideration behind what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's while I love both forms of interviews that we get to do on the show, and I don't think generally speaking, I would ever have really a personal opportunity to interview Julia.
Oh, yeah. No, she's like way out of our league.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, and I'm not, I don't plan on being in Australia anytime soon.
Yeah. I would be cool.
Yes.
For sure.
Yeah.
But it's also
someday.
Yeah. It's just not one of those things you can jump on a plane and go to Australia whenever you want.
And it was like, and I say it profusely in the interview, it was really great to sit down with somebody that I've admired their work for so long and to see, you know, kind of like looking like a watchmaker looking at a watch.
Yeah. She was not at all what I was expecting. She was so normal, but like our kind of normal.
Yeah.
Very just like a cool lady and really, really nice. And I did not realize I was so moved by her work because I actually got like kind of choked up a little bit looking at some of her pieces.
And that's one of the things that first drew me to her work, you know, at the time of discovering her. I mean, the internet was really still not where it is today. You know,
yeah.
You
figured, I mean, 2006, 2007.
I'm still in high school at that point and coming across things, I think on like MySpace and Tumblr and seeing things like that. And I remember the first time I saw one of her pieces, I was incredibly moved by, and she has this way, and I wanted to say it to her during the interview, of making the eyes of the pieces so incredibly lifelike.
Yeah, it doesn't look like the normal kind of taxidermy, at least that I'm used to, because I do come from a family of hunters. We don't have a ton of taxidermy animals, but I mean, I've seen plenty of it. And my dad, so he goes deer hunting every year in November with his brother, and we butcher the deers as the deer as a family, and we eat the whole thing, and then he puts the head out to dry in the sun, and then keeps the skulls. I mean, so it's like something I've always seen because he's done this for years and years and years. Her taxidermy is nothing like that.
No, I had a client for a while that her husband is a taxidermist just like on the side. And I would literally just get so annoying with questions. I would be like, so what does... And like she'd just be like, I don't know anything about it. And I was like, rats.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like when we had Brandy on the show and kind of learning how people are like self-taught or a mentor, like it's still something that I want to cross off of my bucket list.
Yeah.
To learn. When we went to the expo in Salt Lake, there was a class being taught that day of like making your own jackalope taxidermy.
I love that.
But it went the entire day and that just really wasn't going to...
Couldn't work out.
It wasn't going to work. But eventually, I'm sure there will be... And I now own... I didn't realize how many pieces of taxidermy I actually own until today when I was like... Or the other day when I had Antique Study Group here.
Yeah.
And there was... I was like, oh, I do own quite a bit of taxidermy for my house.
Yeah.
And it's all little pieces that I like and the kind of anthropomorphic, macabre, of them.
Yeah, it's definitely not the hunter-centric.
The only one I have that is like traditional Idaho is the pheasant that I found at the DI, which is hilarious to me.
It really is probably the most Idaho Falls thing that could have happened.
And I'm going to re-put him on something else because I don't like the rattan fucking thing that he's on.
Yeah, he needs to be, you know.
Yeah.
He needs some snazz.
Yeah, some pizzazz.
Some vajazzling.
Yes.
Or something.
Yes, pajazzling, because it's a pheasant.
He needs rhinestones.
He does.
You need to send him to Mexikitch and have her bedazzle. Oh, my God.
You hear that, Elrod? I need you to do something with this. Well, I also want to put like a tiny action figure on the back, like a He-Man.
Oh, please do.
Do that whole thing. Please. Add some reins. I really do want a Julia DeVille.
Laser eyes.
Yeah, laser eyes. Pew. That's the noise it would make. We didn't particularly cover, I think, anything in this episode that we felt necessary to like delve into deeper.
Yeah,
Julia
nothing,
did a great job.
Crazy.
Really expanding on the things that she does.
Well, she obviously knows her shit.
No doubt, right? Well, it was really interesting to find out the rise of taxidermy in that part of the world.
Yeah, I always assumed that it was like a very specifically American thing.
I mean, it makes sense.
Because it kind of is, but the fact that it's becoming so popular worldwide, I really like that. Not it's not just our version of taxidermy. It's the kind of more environmentally friendly, kind of more conscious version of taxidermy.
Yeah. And I try my best to support those people that are making ethically sourced taxidermy, like to know where my things are coming from and that they were sourced in a respectful way.
As much as is possible, because sometimes there's just no way to know.
Right. Correct. We did talk about something, and this was in the estate sale walkthrough.
Yeah.
I asked about something that Julia knew about, but it is something that I didn't know about until earlier that day. Mm-hmm. And we asked her about netsuke or netsuki. It can go kind of either way.
Yeah. I've never heard of this.
And it was, I misspoke just slightly about it. It is used as a toggle and a button, but it was specifically used to hold something because during the time that netsukes were made, this comes from japanobjects.com, and it kind of breaks down the different aspects of these pieces. And it was made in 18th and 19th century Japan, in Edo, Japan specifically. It was used for use with wearing of kimonos and kusode. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. And which is a looser, simpler form of a kimono. And it is secured about the waist by obi sashes. Kimono and kusode, however, they don't have any pockets. So regardless of how fine and beautiful the kimono was, it still needed to be practical. And for men in particular. So it became necessary to have something that tied to one's obi's belt.
Oh, so it's kind of like a hanging pocket.
Yeah. So it would be used as a vessel for money and personal effects. And it was used to like suspend like a hand carved wooden box that would have like their money or important things that they needed to carry around while they were wearing a kimono or the other option. And they would hang by a cord and they were anchored in place by the netsuke. So kind of like a, you know, hats where you like move that bead up and down so it stays on your chin. That was how they would do it. And it's so netsuke, they're small palm sized ornaments or smaller, and they're carved from boxwood or ivory. And they often have a hole passing through them from top to bottom where the cord went through. When they first originated, they were simple objects used to hold that in row in place. And then they became, of course, a piece of art and an adornment that you would add with your outfit. Common themes are zodiac animals, creatures of Japanese folklore, monks, no actors, masks, and of course, many more. And there was so much skill that went into it. And so they're made by sculpting and carving. So it starts with the natural materials, the ivory or the boxwood, and they create the desired shape using various knives and chisels. Now, mind you, these are small.
They're tiny.
And they were often themed around folklore, which is why you can kind of roll it over and you kind of see this whole story. Or, oh my gosh, what's the word I'm looking for? The mythology around the piece and what it was. And then they had, it was, so the process could take up to several weeks to make one.
Well, yeah, if it's made out of ivory.
Right. And especially if it had like a human visage, right? Mm-hmm. It was, of course, done by hand by a master carver. And once completed, it would usually be coated in a lacquer, the wood specifically, so that it would be preserved and could be worn daily for many years.
So it's functional art is really what it is.
Yeah.
And they're beautiful.
They're gorgeous. And this is from the 17th to the 19th century, excuse me. So there are different symbolisms that go into them, whether it's for love or something that the person does for a living. And then it goes through to describe the different types of artwork that was put onto them and how it was spun around. And then as it progressed, we talked about this at the end in the curio corner, estate sale walkthrough, how they started to inlay more fine jewels and used like different bits. So like there's a no mask and it has a pearl inlaid and ivory inlaid onto it.
They just got more complex
as they started to continue. And then it was interesting to find out that her mentor actually was making them.
Yeah, that's it. What a thing to put on your resume.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm a master taxidermist, but also
I make these cool things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it.
It was, of course, there's a two people copulating as netsukes.
Yeah, I love this.
They're beautiful. Please, while you're listening to us talk about this, please look them up and have a scroll.
Yeah. And if you know anything more about them, you know,
let us know.
Please.
Yeah, because they are. It's like everything with the show. Once you learn about one more new thing, you're like, all right, well, add it to my list.
Yeah. And if you've got any in your collection, pictures.
Yeah, please send us some pictures. And we were talking about one of Julia's exhibits. She did in Australia. And it was the one we were talking about where it was like a fully immersive experience.
Yeah, my whole brain was on fire thinking about what that would feel like,
mm-hmm.
being able to see the pieces, but also experience certain sounds and mm-hmm. specifically smells that yeah. go along with it. I love that idea. That plays right into my brain box.
Yeah.
And she was, I can't remember which part she was saying, one of the areas in the exhibit, she wanted the smell of ozone to be like part of the exhibit, which sounds amazing because it's such a strong, unique smell, and it really, smell triggers so many things in your mm-hmm. brain.
Incredibly evocative.
But ozone's not good to breathe in. So I'm on the EPA.gov here, the United States Environmental Protection Agency, wondering what exactly is ozone? So it's actually three oxygen atoms chunked together. So it's O3.
Wow.
So my first thought is, what's wrong with that? It's just more oxygen. But it's actually not great for you to inhale. It's one of those things that if you're, so I'm over here, it's talking about what are ozone's acute physiological symptoms and effects. So one of the most prominent effects you're going to get from short-term exposure, which they state as up to 8 hours. And I feel like that's not short-term, but
that's a full day of work.
Yeah.
That's
not healthy.
No.
But I mean, it's going to cause cough, throat irritation, pain, burning, and discomfort in the chest while taking a deep breath.
Wow.
Chest tightness, wheezing, shortness of breath. I mean, this is all like really severe lung-related problems. Basically, it's going to stop your lungs from functioning. It says causes lung function decrements, such as reductions in force. That's a word I don't know. Never mind with that sentence. Basically, it causes your lungs to slowly stop functioning properly. So, good job, Julia, for not putting the ozone into your...
Smart.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the museum was like,
Yeah.
That's why I was like, just give everybody like a mask to wear.
But then you can't smell it. But that's the point because, yeah. So, cool idea. Not great in execution, probably.
Mm-mm.
So.
Okay. And the thing that she mentioned specifically about this exhibit, which we will have the link for on the website.
Yeah, she has it all available as like a virtual walkthrough.
Mm-hmm, like a 3D walkthrough.
Because we can't all go to Australia.
Yeah, which was incredible, an incredible idea. And one of the things that she talks about doing, which was a new interest for her, were creating holograms because of her interest in physics and different things like that. And she will link the interview where she speaks about it specifically for you guys to watch also on YouTube. Yeah. It's a really beautiful depiction of Julia even more so. And what she does for work and how she operates. It's really incredible. So this comes from Wikipedia, just a straightforward example of what a holograph is. So
Holography.
Yeah. It's a technique that enables a wavefront to be recorded and reconstructed later. It's a method of generating three-dimensional images, and it has a wide use of applications. A hologram is made by superimposing a second wavefront, normally called the reference beam, on the wavefront of interest. So it's made with lasers and glass and uses photography to get the image.
It's Star Wars.
Yes. Thereby generating an interference pattern, which is recorded onto a physical medium, like glass. When only the second wavefront illuminates the interface, the interference pattern, it is diffracted to recreate the original wavefront. So that's where that image comes into play.
Right.
Holograms can also be computer generated, which is where you see them as like Leia coming out of R2 and
right. Yes.
In Halo with Katana, like all of those things. Is it Katana? No.
Cortana.
Cortana. Thank you. And so the resulting digital image is then printed onto a suitable mask or film and illuminated by a light source. So Julia got into those with this new interest in physics and different things like that and wanted to have another experience of where it's images of her taxidermy experienced in that three-dimensional hologram. And she uses these beautiful, ornate antique frames and...
Which I love that she put the antique frame around the, like, hyper scientific hologram. That's a great, it kind of almost feels like a joke, like an inside joke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm excited to, I'm going to watch it. And I'll send you the link for it so you can see it too.
Yes, please.
Cause I'm excited to have that immersive experience and to see.
What a generous thing to just like put that out for everybody.
Right. And the amount of work that had to have gone into that.
Yeah.
And then we talk about, at the very end, I ask her this burning question about this ghost named Edith. And I specifically was like, I am interested to see if there is an article about her. And we found the one article on her.
Yeah, we know who she is. People know who she is.
Yes.
She's a documented apparition.
Yes. Let me find this article really quickly. Because there's one person in particular that was doing the work for Edith. And this was back in 2014. And Edith's full name is Edith Judd. And she was wrongfully accused of suicide.
That is the right way to put it in this situation, I think. Mm-hmm. Wrongfully accused. Because it is very accusatory how they treated it.
So this article that we found specifically is from theage.com.au. And the National Trust of Victoria unearths historic murder mystery of Edith Judd.
Ooh.
The National Trust of Victoria, they have been stunned to discover the murder on their own doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
Research into the history of the Trust headquarters, Tasma Terrace, which is where Julia DeVille's studio now is at Tasma Terrace.
Didn't she say that the part of the building that this particular murder happened in is actually gone
has been
now?
Demolished, but the initial site and some of the buildings still exist, and it's in East Melbourne, found that in 1890, Edith Judd, she managed the lodging house on site, and she was shot dead there. The staffs at the Trust, which has occupied this row of terraces on Parliament Place for 36 years, they did not know about it, and they're calling to the public for help. This was, again, in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Lizzie Anya Petrivna was the curator, and she made the discovery that she believes Mrs. Judd was wronged. And by being judged by the courts and the media of the day, by having committed suicide. And then it goes to list some of the stuff that was from those documents that they found.
Mm-hmm.
So she died in her first floor bedroom from two gunshots to the head, which Julia mentions.
Yeah, you can't do that yourself. Yeah.
And so she would have had to recock the gun in between. Her lover, Alfred Turner, who lived on the premises, had been abusive and threatened to shoot her because she knew that she had a morbid fear of guns.
Does it say what kind of gun it was?
Mm-mm. Not in this article, and I couldn't find another one after this.
Well, just coming from a background where I'm pretty familiar, the first thing I think of is, A, she's shooting with her left hand.
Mm-hmm.
Guns were not designed, even now they're not designed for smaller hands.
Women, and it would have been a revolver.
It would have been a revolver. She mm-hmm. would have been tiny. Mm-hmm. There is no way she could have used her own left hand mm-hmm. to shoot herself even once, probably.
Right. So, and the gun was found in her left hand, right? And she was right-handed. Mm-hmm. Turner was tried for the murder, but he was acquitted.
Of course.
He claimed in court to have argued with her and dodged a bullet that she fired at him before she shot herself, which is like, let's get some different stories, guys.
Yeah.
In the trial, the coroner's inquest from the Public Record Office of Victoria, she was portrayed as someone, of course, because she was a woman with loose morals and a great flirt.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Miss Petrivna says one horrible article hinted that she'd formerly been on the stage and that she'd left Perth under a cloud of scandal.
What does that even mean?
Yeah, because she'd been doing things with military men, which it's just bullshit.
So
we all know it's bullshit.
She was a woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she was also described as an attractive woman and a good conversationalist. And this is so fucked up. The autopsy described her as well endowed.
Ew. So it's because she was hot.
Yeah. Miss Anya Petrivna, she discovered the boarding house had been respectable. So the people that lived at this boarding house, they were unmarried women, including teachers and nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And then barristers and journalists also lived there.
Okay.
So it was not a hostel where like of ill acclaim, right? Like people would want.
It wasn't an hourly rate kind of place.
No.
And even if it were,
mm-hmm.
let's give, you know, the benefit of the doubt to the person who actually died.
Right. So Miss Anna Petrivna said that over the years there have been ghost sightings at Tasma Terrace, including a buxom woman standing on the third floor photocopier.
Ooh.
There were rumors of something nasty had happened in the building, but nobody had been able to like categorically point to an event.
Mm-hmm.
Until they discovered that it was actually a pretty gruesome murder.
Yeah.
So they stumbled upon the case, and there was an article at the Argus, which was August 15th, 1890. The article published the day after the death deemed it was an attempted murder-suicide and the outcome of a woman's jealousy.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. And then Miss Anya Petrivna called for a reappraisal. She reckons that Alfred Turner did it. And she says, and I quote, "I want justice for Edith. I feel as if she wanted me to find the story." She admits now that she has become completely and utterly obsessed with the case. They gave a tour at the National Trust Heritage Festival. They gave a free tour of the terrace. She's written about the murder, and she at the time was thinking about writing a book, and they were seeking the public's help at the time to find photos of Edith and the descendants of her three children, Fanny, Hatfield, and Richard, from the failed marriage.
I am going to have to find that book if it was ever written.
Right. So yeah, that was, I'm glad that we were able to find something about her, and that she's one that people were like, this is not okay. She mm-hmm. needs to have proper justice, even if it was over 100 years ago.
Yeah. I'd be a ghost too. I'd be pissed.
Right. So I thought that was interesting, and I had seen it a couple times mentioned while looking up Julia. Yeah. And yeah, that was an absolute treat to have her on the show. Please go and look at all of the links we have listed at themothballprophecies.com, as well as on our Instagram at themothballpropheciesoriginal. Be sure to go and follow Julia's work and do a deep Google dive
Please.
On it, because she's an exceptional person, and she's exceptionally talented. And
she is an artist in every sense of the word.
Mm-hmm, 100%. Right now, we would like to thank some of our favorite people, our patrons. Without them, a lot of the show would not be possible, and traveling would also not be possible. So our endless gratitude to all of you. We've actually started to put together really great October bags. So if you're listening to this and you have not joined the Patreon, join to get the exceptional holiday bags that are going to be coming out over the next couple of months. Right now, we would like to thank Katrina and Erica in Arizona,
Gray in Colorado,
Emily and Crystal in Nevada,
Ruth in British Columbia,
Ruby and Autumn in Ohio,
Aaron in Wisconsin,
RJ in Florida,
Gina in South Carolina,
Julia in Sweden,
Jasmine in Kentucky,
Kyla in Indiana,
Javier, Shanna, Mandy, and Riley in California,
Betty, Lisa, Aaron, TC Lionel, Melissa, Christina, Becky, and Ashley in Idaho. A gigantic thank you to our wonderful team. Gray, you make us sound great every week, and we truly appreciate it. And of course, to our dear Spellcheck.
Me!
Thank you, really, for doing all you do behind the scenes for us and making us actually look like we know how to punctuate. Me, specifically.
I have imposter syndrome.
I know, but you do a great job. Thanks. We really appreciate you. As always, I hope you find some good shit.
And remember to do your research.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye.